are listening to True Crime Fiction, feeding your addiction to the best of the written and the spoken word in crime. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so for as little as £1 at patreon.com/truecrimefiction. Back in the early days of True Crime Fiction, I reviewed a BBC podcast called Who Killed Emma? A really excellent and brave piece of journalism from Sam Powling. The case covered the death of Emma Caldwell, who was found dead in Woodland in Lanarkshire, outside Glasgow in April 2005. Last week, Ian Packer was found guilty and sentenced to a minimum of 36 years for killing Emma. It is the second longest sentence handed down in Scottish criminal history. The longest goes to Angus Sinclair, guilty of the World's End murders. It has taken a very long time to find justice. As mentioned in my original review, the investigation took a disastrous turn when it focused exclusively on a group of Turkish men and eventually collapsed. Packer was left free for almost 20 years to continue terrorising the women who came into his orbit, despite police asking their superiors to charge him in 2007. Reporting suggests that superiors were too focused on the Turkish men, and it is suggested that Police Scotland and the Crown Office were too embarrassed by their mistakes to put them right. What we know of Ian Packer, both from the original podcast and from new reporting now the trial has finished, is that he has been a danger to women for a long time. There had been multiple reports to the police of assaults and rapes committed by him across his lifetime. Some news outlets say one woman who reported a serious sexual assault by Packer was arrested for prostitution and put in police cells. To remind listeners, this is not a story happening in the 1800s, but rather within the last few decades. The First Minister of Scotland, Humza Yousaf, has opened an inquiry into what happened. So it is likely that we will, after some time, find out more about what the decision-making and motivations were that allowed this man to go free after killing, and perhaps even allowed him to kill. At this point, we don't know if there may have been a chance to arrest and charge Packer with crimes before he killed Emma, which may have changed the course of his behaviour. Of course, there is a chance that an earlier intervention by the justice system would have done little, given it appears like his misogyny has been deeply ingrained from an early age. In the same week of Packer's sentencing, we have also seen an investigation into previous offending from Wayne Cousins, the serving police officer who kidnapped and murdered Sarah Everard in 2021, throwing the police into an unprecedented crisis of confidence when it comes to their ability to protect women. An investigation by Lady Eilish Angelini, who was previously Scotland's Lord Advocate, uncovered a series of sexual assaults, including one on a girl barely in her teens. These were not reported at the time, possibly because there are multiple barriers to women reporting rape and sexual assault to the police. What had been reported was a series of indecent exposures committed by Cousins, but despite there being records of this, he was still allowed to serve in three different police forces. This is a testament to the fact that indecent exposure is not considered serious. There is still something of a wink-wink, nudge-nudge joke about it. I have been on the receiving end of indecent exposure twice in my life. At least once it was a large and intimidating man in a busy pub in Edinburgh in front of dozens of people. He appeared to think it was hilarious, and so did his friends. What women desperately need is for the police and the justice system to take their safety seriously. For men like Packer and Cousins to be identified earlier as having problem behaviour. Had either of these men faced the consequences of their actions where their actions were less serious than murder, who knows which woman may be alive today and which woman would not be dealing with the psychological effects of being sexually assaulted and then not believed. Real protection for women, though, goes further. Throwing someone in jail sometimes may be what is needed to keep people safe, but jailing people at a point when our jails are almost at capacity and poor economics means excellence in rehabilitation as a pipe dream does not feel like a solution. What is also needed is intervention at an earlier stage, which helps people change their behaviour before it has become ingrained. This is why Lady Eilish Angelini's call for indecent exposure to be taken more seriously is so important. We need a society where early indicators of problems are believed, men are able to ask for help, and a good quality, well-funded mental health support is there for those who are brave enough to confront their problems. In Alex Sharkey's book, My Brother the Killer, he struggled to understand why his younger brother had killed his own niece. The answers to these questions are never neat and tidy. What Alex did uncover was that the violence at home and his father's alcoholism played some part. Alex never went on to murder someone, though, despite living in the same home and having the same father. So he delves further and finds that the school his brother was sent to had teachers working there who were sexually abusing the boys. It is highly likely that many more boys than we understand are sexually abused. However, because of attitudes of the past and present, such as anger being the only acceptable emotion for men, that men are always up for sex and that they need to be the sexual aggressor, means it can be incredibly difficult for them to come forward or even admit to themselves what has happened to them was bad and that they deserve redress and healing. It is not just in the area of men's mental health and their safety that we need to focus on to create a culture where women are not sexually assaulted. We need a culture where women are not sexually objectified, where we have feminist budgeting and town planning, and really importantly, other men being willing to and knowing how to call in their friends, family members and colleagues when their behaviour and attitudes towards women fall short. It is truly a quest that needs us to reimagine society, a change and an update to the furniture of our lives. Of course, giving money for the mental health of sexual offenders and those in jail is not going to be a popular move. It can be very hard for those on the outside to find timely and reasonably priced mental health support. So people naturally bristle at those behind bars having what they perceive as an easier time of it. I suspect deep down that they do not think it is easy enough that they would swap places. However, without thorough and rigorous interventions in offenders' mental health and a well-resourced and clear-eyed rehabilitation, we risk a system which convicts and then releases offenders only to offend again, creating a horrible cycle. It feels to me that this is more of a system of deference, working on a wing and a prayer, hoping that enough women will steer clear of dangerous men. Of course, those hopes rely on unrealities. the unreality that it is easy to tell who is dangerous and who is not, the unreality that social conventions do not encourage women to aggressively protect themselves, and most people will find themselves somewhere in flight, fawn, or freeze when faced with danger. This is not a movie, so those who sexually assault us do not come in the guise of an obvious villain, and women do not suddenly know kung fu. Instead, most crime is opportunistic. So the people who attack us are found in clubs, pubs, supermarkets, work nights out, schools, colleges, parks, shopping centres, our own homes, the places where we are every day. Yet, women are expected to behave as though the reality of crime is not where crime is played out, but rather in an unreal universe, mainly made of imagining a best-case scenario for us, rather than the real world, where it is virtually impossible to live a life and thrive without coming into contact with someone who may not have the purest of intentions towards you. Of course, there are some people who are too dangerous, too violent, and too unrepentant to ever be free. A system of rehabilitation does not mean that we also have to be blind to the potential some people hold within themselves for incredible violence and harm to others. This is not a question of either rehabilitation or punishment. Rather, like most tricky questions, the answer lies somewhere in the middle of the two binary extremes the debate gets reduced to. I would argue that safety, and especially the safety of vulnerable people, should always be first, and that given the right resources, it is possible to have a rehabilitation with a safety primacy. If we reject the barbarism of the death penalty, we need to find ways that people can do more than rot in jail, but offer a path to atonement for those who are willing and able to take it. Many people will ask, why would rapists and sex offenders deserve the kind of intensive mental health support the rest of us struggle to access? Why should the resources of our country, at a time when things are more stretched and difficult than ever, be put towards people who have harmed others rather than the harmed? I would counter by saying that it's not about whether these sexual offenders deserve excellent mental health support. We all do. It's about if the women in your lives deserve to be safe. My answer is that at the end of the day, we cannot have safety for all women if we do not address the root causes of male violence. Misogyny is a hydra, a many-headed beast from Greek mythology. It was undefeated because when one head was cut off, two grew back in its place. That is, until Hercules came and cauterized the stump of each neck after the severing, making sure it could not regrow. If we are truly to defeat misogyny, and the great deal of harm it does to both men and women, as well as our children, we need to all work together to make our voices heard and to ensure that proper and timely interventions can be made with any cousins or packer who is growing up now, instead of waiting until they have become so twisted that they take a life. And now you can hear my original review of Who Killed Emma. While I try to avoid spoilers in my reviews, with this one it's not been possible, mainly because the pod progresses in a way I want to discuss and talk about, which is a testament to how powerful a piece of investigative journalism it is. If you do not want spoilers, then please listen to Who Killed Emma and then come back to this review and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Who Killed Emma is another deep dive investigation from the BBC, this time from BBC Scotland, by Sam Pooling and producer Monica McAlladen. Emma Caldwell is a lively, kind girl who grew up in a loving family. When her sister died from cancer at a young age, Emma understandably struggled with grief. Boyfriend introduced her to heroin, and from there her life spiralled as she turned to sex work to fund the addiction. Emma's family never lost hope, tried to get her medical help, and stayed in touch with her regularly until the day she stopped answering their calls. This is when the police get involved, and shortly after, Emma's body is found and a murder investigation starts. Pooling has been asked by one of Emma's clients to help him clear his name, as he was questioned by the police 6 times and it has cast an intolerable pall over his life. Over the course of the investigation, the client becomes close to Pooling. It is obvious that he feels their relationship is one of reciprocal friendship, while Pooling, ever the professional, maintains a detached contact. The image he presents to the investigative journalist is one of a gentle, loving man who has made mistakes but is horribly wronged and had his life destroyed. It's almost becoming a trope of sex-related crime. As Pooling continues her investigation, she uncovers not only missed opportunities, but that the client has a long-term and serious record of sexual violence against women. Once she has gathered her evidence, Pooling confronts the man. I was genuinely afraid for Pooling when she confronts the client with his blatant lies and her belief he is in fact guilty of Emma's death. It is the scariest and most tense true crime moment I have heard on any podcast, and Pooling's courage should not be underestimated. It is clear the client comes close to violence, and in fact, 2 days later, he's arrested for assaulting the girlfriend who earlier attested to his lack of violence. And that just illustrates the simmering rage and misogyny contained in this man. The client gets 2 years for the attack on his girlfriend and is out in one and has never been arrested for Emma's death or the mountain of sexual assaults and rapes many women have reported to the police throughout his lifetime. This is where true crime differs from crime fiction. If this was fiction, the case would be resolved. We could see women having their day in court and receiving justice. As this is true crime, we are left with the impression of women who've been massively let down by the police, a society that does not believe women, and the justice system. It's almost becoming a trope of sex-related crime. Pooling does spend time discussing the decision to include the interview where she puts her accusations to the clients, which police asked her not to broadcast, and I found it difficult to sort through my feelings about it. On one hand, it is probably good people can be knowledgeable about such a dangerous man. On the other, I wonder if it could indeed hamper any case that in future could be brought to court. The problem is that the police, by nature of their job, have to keep a lot under wraps and secret, so there is no way of knowing if what Pooling has broadcast could be detrimental. The latest news reports say that the police are reviewing the case, and it's expected that a breakthrough may come soon. So we may have an answer to our question then. Pooling does a sterling job, and I feel that she probably made the best decision she could, given the information that she had in her possession at the time. But I still feel an uncomfortable territory caught between the safety that women deserve and the need to secure a conviction. Another area where I could not shake a slight feeling of unease was that of the surveillance operation on a Turkish cafe police suspected may hold Emma's murderer. The men in the cafe were arrested and charged. However, the police employed 2 people to translate recorded conversations who had told them they were not fluent or expert in Turkish, and inevitable mistakes ensued. The case, which had so far cost £4 million, collapsed, and it is suggested that the focus on the Turkish men stopped the police looking for other suspects. What leaves me uncomfortable is that there is a distinct whiff of structural racism in the events around the translation. One of the men arrested later successfully sued over his arrest. They were also taking part in abusive and illegal activity, which I am assuming is why there's been no outcry. It does feel to me, however, that there was some more to delve into there. I suspect the team behind Who Killed Emma wanted to focus on how the safety of women is often ignored by society. Some of the sex workers interviewed would tell of how they would make sure to drop hair in a client's car, so if they do turn up dead, there will be a link to their killer. As a woman, I've been aware of women's lack of safety and protection since I was a child, and my older sister told me if I'm ever raped, I need to call out fire, because that's the only way people will come and help. None of this is news to me. It's not news to most people, I suspect, but still nothing changes. Perhaps Who Killed Emma will be an important part of the voice-raising effort that is needed to make change happen. But for the moment, I think many would settle for a conviction. You have been listening to True Crime Fiction, the podcast that is feeding your addiction to all things crime. You can find our website at true-crime-fiction.com, on Twitter at true_crime_fic, on Facebook and Instagram as True Crime Fiction. Please rate and review on the podcast app of your choice. Music is by Kitty Kitty Meow Meow.
What a depressing note to end on.